We're here at the 2012 World Food Prize Symposium, and with me is Dr. Daniel Hillel, who is the 2012 World Food Prize laureate. And first of all, Dr. Hillel, I'd like you to just tell me a little bit about yourself.
If you can condense that into...
I'll condense the course of 82 years into a few...
You could probably spend more than 10 minutes just talking about yourself.
Into a few sentences. Well, I was born in the fair city of Los Angeles, California. But it was in the depths of the Depression. And tragically, my father died about a year after my birth. And my mother suddenly found herself with five children, the youngest of whom was an infant, and with a business that went bankrupt, a thriving business that went bankrupt, and not knowing what to do, she decided to join her parents, who had left earlier, 3 years earlier, left the fair city of Charleston, South Carolina, to go and live out their lives in the Holy Land. So she took us across the continent and boarded a ship and sailed halfway around the world to a faraway country, the land of the Bible. And shall I tell you about our arrival there?
Sure.
I don't remember it, but my sisters told me how it was. There was no seaport in Palestine of 1931-32 able to accommodate ocean-going vessels, and so the ship lay anchor some distance from the shore, and the family was taken on a rowboat and rowed ashore, and when they arrived in the old seaport of Jaffa, that's the seaport from which Jonah set out to be swallowed by a whale. Those who know the Bible would recognize the story. Anyhow, they got off the boats with their trunks, and there they saw children standing on the boat landing with huge black eyes. And they were very, very befuddled until they came up close and they saw that these were Arab children with pussy eyes and hundreds of black flies stuck to their eyes. It was a disease called trachoma that was just rampant in the Middle East at the time. And they thought, oh my God, what have we come to? And then in the heat and the tumult of July 1932, at the edge of this crowd, they saw a frail old man, Grandpa, who had rented a horse-drawn buggy to carry them with their trunks to a little apartment that he had rented for them in the outskirts of the ancient city of Jaffa and the beginnings of a new city called Tel Aviv. And that's how our lives began in what was then a very backward and very unmodernized country, uncomfortable country. And at age 8, the family decided to put me on a kibbutz, because I was an unruly child and they couldn't quite contain me. So they put me on a pioneering settlement in the Jezreel Valley. At age 8, I was given a spade and asked to go to the field and help to irrigate trees, young saplings. And as I stood there barefoot, feeling how the trickling waters running down a furrow softened the harsh clods, and watching the water, frothing water, irrigate the tender saplings. In the midst of this vast expanse of desolation, it just captivated me. And that determined my professional life. I was so fascinated by the water softening the harsh clods and the tender saplings growing up, and I had a spade in hand and I could direct the water. And well, after that,
that's a beautiful story. I mean, I just get that visual, and that's really what you were honored for here, was developing micro irrigation then. And it started when you were 8 years old. What a beautiful story.
Yes. And after that, when came the time for me to go to college, and my mother returned me to the United States at age 15 after the end of the Second World War, and deposited me with an with a brother of hers who was the justice of the peace in the old city of Charleston, South Carolina. And I decided that I want to be independent, so they registered me to a military academy that had a dormitory. So I didn't have to live with relatives. I could be independent, as if independent. And I became a cadet at Porter Military Academy. That's an old school that had a great Civil War tradition and pride of the South. And I excelled in my studies, and I finished at age 16. I graduated with the highest grade point average in the history of the Porter Military Academy. And so that started me on a career of studies. I then went to college and finished my bachelor's degree when I was 19 and my master's degree at age 20. And I chose to study agriculture and soil science and hydrology. Those are the things that interested me most. And then I returned to Israel in the year 1951, shortly after the establishment of the state. And my first job there, working for the Ministry of Agriculture, was mapping the soils of the country. So we started up north, and I was given an old World War II Jeep and a few instruments and a few assistants, and we began just mapping, for the first time, mapping the soils of what was then the new state of Israel. And as we worked our way south, I was just fascinated by the desert, the Negev Desert. And so I joined with a band of adventurers. There were 12 of us all together, and we ventured into the highlands of the desert, a very desolate region at the time. And we established the first agricultural settlement, or what we hoped would become an agricultural settlement, and indeed became an agricultural settlement. But it took years. And we began exploring the region and looking for ways of... There wasn't enough rainfall for agriculture, but the little rain that did occur trickled off the slopes of the hills and collected in the bottomlands, and we could concentrate that water and raise crops in the wadi beds, in the creek beds, if we could terrace them and stop the floods from running away. And about a year after we went down there, in the course of the first year, the region was so insecure that we lost three of our original members, who were killed by marauders, and it was very insecure. And then about a year later, as we were struggling, one day we noticed a convoy traveling south along this dirt road, chugging and raising dust that was about a half a mile from our camp. And among the military vehicles was a black limousine. That was very puzzling to us. But then, as it was heading south, suddenly the convoy stopped and turned to our little settlement. And the doors of the limousine opened, and out stepped a gentleman, an elderly man, with frizzy white hair, whom we instantly recognized as David Ben-Gurion, the father of Israel, the George Washington of Israel. And he wanted to know, what are you doing here? And we said, well, we're trying to find a way of bringing life to this desert. And he said, but how many are you? And we said, well, we were 12 at first, and we lost 3 of our members, but we were joined by others, so we're now 15. He said, but that's not enough. You need more people. He said, yes. He said, what are the requirements for membership? And we said, well, people who are willing to work and are congenial. He said, would you accept an elderly couple? And we thought he was joking, so he said, well, yes, if they're willing to work. And now the unbelievable happened. He cut the trip short, returned to Jerusalem, resigned from the government, and came to join our little village as a member, together with his elderly wife. And the guys just absolutely didn't know what to do with him, and so they gave him to me. And they said, Danny, you take care of him. Put him to work as much as you can, but otherwise just take care of him. So I had, at the age of 22, had a very close relationship with one of the great men of our generation. I would go to see him every evening, sit down to talk to him, ostensibly to give him the assignment for the following day, but really to engage him in conversation. From time to time, I had the temerity to argue with him a little bit. And after a while, he was visited by all sorts of dignitaries, including the then Secretary General of the United Nations, whose name was Doug Hammarskjöld. And on one occasion, a helicopter appeared and landed, and out stepped the Prime Minister of a faraway country called Burma. And his name was U Nu. And he asked Ben-Gurion if Ben-Gurion could send some agricultural experts to Burma to help the Burmese develop their frontier provinces, because they were afraid that the Chinese might encroach or they would lose control. The Burmese are mostly people who live in the river valley, but they have uplands, and they wanted to be able to settle these uplands. And so it was that I suddenly found myself sent from the deserts of Southwest Asia to the rainforests, to the jungles of Southeast Asia. And and I spent a couple of years there opening an experiment station, developing. You need to go?
We need to move. Apparently they're having a press conference here.
And we need to... He needs to rest.
Yes, you need to rest. But I just want to... Yeah, go ahead. Okay, come on. All right, over here. Go ahead.
And that started a career, an international career for me. And I had, in the meantime, completed my doctorate doing research on the soils and the water relations of the desert lands. And I then was invited to join the faculty of the university in the country. And I also became involved internationally in sort of work. And the rest is history. I've served in about 30 or 40 countries around the world, and have served as a professor and had many graduate students, and wrote 20-some-odd books and several hundred research articles. And that wraps me up at age 82.
Well, you've had an amazing life, and I'm sure you've seen a lot of interesting things occur in agriculture during your life. So what I'd like to get, I know you're your guy wants to move you along here, but your perspective now at age 82, looking at the world as it is and looking ahead to a growing world population, how do you feel about how we're going to feed the world in the years to come?
It isn't just feeding the world. it's protecting its resources. It's protecting its biosphere. It's protecting plant and animal life and natural ecosystems. I'm very concerned about that. And preventing the climate from changing and accommodating to the damage that we've done already and preventing a worsening situation. So we have a great problem. When I was a child, the population of the world was something like 1 billion. The population of the world is now 7 billion and growing and projected to reach 9 billion by the middle of the century. And in the meantime, we've degraded the soils and we've depleted water resources. We need to be very careful. We've encroached upon natural ecosystems and we're causing the decimation of biodiversity of plants and animals. We are responsible for the world now. We have to be very careful how we manage it. And to be able to preserve natural ecosystems, we have to intensify the way we manage selected parcels of land. And it is possible indeed to intensify production and do it sustainably in a way that would not degrade the land. And so also we've begun to change the climate. That's of great concern. We have to stop spewing out into the atmosphere these heat-trapping gases, these carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide, and these gases, and be responsible for the world that we've taken over. And that's my concern now and my research. I'm associated with the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, a branch of NASA, associated with Columbia University, and my major study now at the present time is climate change, impacts on agriculture, and ways of reducing that impact.
Are you optimistic of the brains that are coming into the world now to be able to find ways to do the things that you have just outlined?
I am realistic. I realize that there are great problems. I'm not pessimistic that they can't be solved. I believe they can be solved, so I'm a conditional optimist. I'm an optimist on the condition that we do what is necessary, that we educate the younger generation to take responsibility and that we manage our affairs internationally, cooperatively. We've taken over the world. We're responsible for it now. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. Here at the World Food Prize, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.